From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. House Democrats vote today on police reform. Their bill is expected to pass, but reform has stalled in the Senate. Yesterday, Democrats blocked a bill drafted by Republicans. Senator Doug Jones, Democrat of Alabama, joins us now. Senator, welcome.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
Well, let's start with police reform. Democrats blocked the Republican legislation in the Senate yesterday on a procedural vote. You were one of only two Democrats who voted yes to proceed. Now, most Democrats say the bill was fatally flawed, so there was no reason to debate it. Why did you disagree?
Well, it's not that I disagree that the bill as written is fatally flawed. I think it is. I would not have voted for the bill ultimately as it is. I just think that we need to have a debate on the floor of the Senate. And I think if we had done that, you know, the American people would have seen the flaws in Senator Scott's bill. Unfortunately, I don't think Senator McConnell wants to do that. He wants to make sure that people don't see that. And that's kind of a bad place where we are right now.
Well, the Republican bill did not include Democratic priorities like banning chokeholds. It didn't end no-knock warrants or qualified immunity. Would you be willing to support an eventual bill that does not include those things?
No, I doubt it. Now, that's not to say that there couldn't be some language that can be added to a bill that would strengthen the bill as is. But I think those are very, very important things that we have to talk about. And I think you have to do that in an open and frank debate and not just through dueling press conferences, which is what we see in the Senate today. The way to get something done is to put the language out there. Let's talk about it. Let's debate it. See where we can do it. The one thing that I think was most disappointing is that Senator McConnell completely rejected any discussions, any sending to Judiciary Committee, sending to an ad hoc committee of bipartisan senators to try to work out these differences. We could have done that as well, I believe, but he completely rejected that. Instead, wanted to put a bill on the floor that had only been written about a week earlier.
Well, if the Senate cannot agree on a bill and Republicans say that the House bill is dead on arrival, then do you think that it's possible that after all these protests in cities across the country, that Congress will do absolutely nothing?
I think it's possible, but I am going to be hopeful that that's not the case. I still believe that there is a political will in the United States Senate to try to get something done. It may not be as strong as the House passed bill or the one that's going to pass today, but I do think in talking to colleagues, there is the political will to get something done, because I think we're at a moment in history in which the American public from all walks of life, all races, religions, and political persuasions are demanding it.
As you know, we're having a national debate right now about Confederate monuments, and you've supported some bipartisan legislation to remove Confederate names and symbols from military bases. What do you say to people who want all the markers of racist figures from the past to be removed from public spaces, or where do you draw the line?
I've always said that this should be a matter left to local authorities and the public. I think you start with where we are with the Confederacy. The Confederacy was with generals that took up arms against the United States of America. And I think what the Armed Services Committee did a couple of weeks ago was a really important step in recognizing that. Now, there are serious, serious barriers to racial justice in this country. We're talking about housing. We're talking about voting. We're talking about health care disparities. I don't want to see folks get so focused on names and symbols as opposed to the real barriers that are out there. I think that we can reach that sweet spot where we can do both, and I think it's going to take some dialogue, and nothing can happen overnight because there are other views that also have to be taken in.
So do you disagree with people who are just ripping down monuments on their own?
I would like to see folks at this point go to their governments and give these governments a chance. As I said earlier, we are at such an important point in history. You are seeing the symbols falling left and right. And what I'm saying is, let folks look at this. I'm not saying wait, but, you know, I've never advocated any kind of violent action whatsoever. I think that there are ways to do this. And I think we are at a point now where everybody is listening and everybody is studying and everybody looking and wanting to make sure that we do the right thing, that we are trying to do what's best for America.
Let me ask you about COVID-19. Alabama is among the states seeing a surge right now. Confirmed cases went from fewer than 20,000 at the start of June to more than 30,000. Now hospitalizations are up. Alabama is now on New York's quarantine list. Does Alabama need to consider rolling back its reopening?
I think we're going to have to start looking at that, at least on the local levels. I think Alabama did the right thing, and we started out very slowly trying to reopen. But people were so frustrated and wanted to get out that they didn't listen to the second part of the message, and that is it is still safer at home. You still need to wear a mask. You still need to social distance. And people just got out, and they've let their guard down. And they see all of these things happening on national television with the president and others who are basically writing this virus off, and they think, okay, it's all right to do. Well, it's not all right to do. We have got to get past the political correctness of wearing a mask and get into the fact that it is a health issue.
Well, should masks be mandatory nationwide, do you think?
I don't know about mandatory nationwide, but I think if people can accept responsibility, we won't have to do that. And the places where you're seeing the rise, if you're seeing these hot spots, then local officials ought to take the bull by the horns and do what is necessary to protect people.
Well, should masks be mandatory statewide in Alabama then, because it's seeing a surge?
I think we're getting close to that. If folks don't start paying attention, I don't know whether the governor will do it or not. But I think right now, with the more publicity we're getting and we're seeing, the last time I was at home, and I'm headed back there today, there were more people wearing masks than I've seen in over a month because of what's happening. And if we can continue in that direction, we will be able to keep this under control.
What about economic relief? We spoke with Senator Rick Scott last week, Republican, who told us that if there is more relief coming for Americans, it would be at the end of July. Would you like to pass another multi-trillion-dollar relief package before then?
Well, I'd like to pass another relief package before then. I don't know what the dollar figure would be. I wanted to pass something last month, and I think we have to start doing something to kind of wean off the unemployment compensation but give businesses the opportunity to keep people on the payroll. That's the Paycheck Security Program that I have with Senator Warner and others, to let businesses open up safe and effectively and let the federal government continue to provide some relief so that we don't have another incredible dip in our economy.
That is Doug Jones, Democratic Senator from Alabama. Senator, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Jeremy. Take care.
Well, today the Labor Department reported nearly 1.5 million more people filed for unemployment benefits last week, bringing the total to 47 million since the coronavirus pandemic began battering the American economy in mid-March. NPR's chief economics correspondent Scott Horsley is here for a brief reminder of where we are. And Scott, 1.5, very high by historical standards, much less, though, than some of these other weekly numbers we've seen. So give us the context here.
Well, you're right, Robin. We're seeing fewer weekly claims now than we were in late March and April, but it's not declining very much. The claims have been sort of holding steady in that 1.5 million for the last 3 weeks or so, and that's sort of worrisome. And then on top of that, you have another 700,000 people who applied last week for the special federal unemployment insurance for folks who are self-employed or gig workers and aren't eligible under the usual state program. So there's still very, very high unemployment. We know that as of June 6th, there were north of 30 million people receiving unemployment. Some 4.5 million more people have applied since then. So it's still a really weak job market right now.
And which sectors are being hit the hardest?
Well, the weekly claims don't give you a whole lot of information about where these jobs are being lost, but we're still seeing job losses in food service, for example. And, you know, Senator Jones was just talking about the hot spots in Alabama. It's possible that some of the restaurants that tried reopening are now closing their doors again and sending workers away because they're just not getting a lot of traffic with the flare-ups in new infections. We know from reservation sites and so forth that there are places that have seen an uptick in infections and hospitalizations are seeing a downturn in restaurant reservations and traffic at stores and that sort of thing. So we could be looking at, if not a second wave of infections, at least a second wave in economic slowdown.
Yeah, and we just heard Jeremy ask Senator Jones about the possibility of more relief coming from Congress. Lawmakers, we know, boosted the unemployment benefits during the pandemic, that extra 600 or whatever a week, but that money is slated to run out soon. So what's your sense there?
Yeah, that extra $600 a week in unemployment insurance is due to expire at the end of July, and it certainly seems as if Congress is taking their time in deciding whether or not to extend that. So people who are receiving that extra $600 a week are probably going to be in limbo at least until late July to know whether that's going to continue. And that has been really important in propping up consumer spending. We've seen in the spending data that spending has actually held up better than it otherwise might by virtue of those government benefits. Government benefits have really put a floor under consumer spending that otherwise would have cratered even more than it did. And if those extra $600 a week in uninsurance benefits go away, that's going to be a real hardship. I mean, if we're talking about 35 million people who are unemployed, even as businesses are reopening and people are getting their jobs back, you know, at the pace we saw last month, we're looking at elevated unemployment for 10 months or more.
Oh, that's tough. NPR's chief economics correspondent, Scott Horsley. Scott, as always, thank you.
Glad to do it, Robin.
In early April, we spoke with Inder Singh, founder of Kinza Health. They make the Kinza Smart Thermometers, the ones that connect to an app so users can upload their health data to the internet and make it available to scientists who can then track disease outbreaks as they start through clusters of fevers. And because the thermometers are used at home, days or weeks before a patient sees a doctor, this data can predict hotspots 2 to 3 weeks before the CDC can. It's been very effective for flu and now COVID-19. When we spoke, Kinza had already predicted the massive outbreaks in New York and Boston. So months later, with states reopening and yesterday's record daily high of new cases nationwide, more than 36,000, more than the last single day high in April, we're checking back in with Inder Singh to find out what he sees now. Inder joins us from San Francisco by Skype. Inder, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
And first, let's remind people how this works. You caused quite a bit of excitement. I ordered my Kinza thermometer. It took a long time to get here because so many people flocked to get these because they wanted to be part of this data. But for those who are thinking, wait a minute, I don't want my boss to know I have a fever. I don't want anyone. This is anonymous, right? It's just the information about a fever, not who has it.
That's right. Everything is aggregated and anonymous. So if you go to healthweather.us, which we launched in mid-March, what you'll see there is fever levels across the country, the percentage of people that are ill. It's not possible to identify an individual based on a population level calculation like that.
Yeah. Well, public health officials, including Peter Hotez at Baylor in Texas, William Schaffner in New York, very excited about your data. After states shut down their economies, your thermometers showed that social distancing was working. Why? What were you seeing?
Yeah, we were seeing within 3 to 7 days, declining levels of fever. It showed that people's sacrifices at home were working. People should know that they were helping to save others' lives. And we were thrilled to be able to contribute that data. Because until that point, there really wasn't a good data source to say, is it working? This was essentially a real-time data source to say, it is working.
Yeah. That was closings. Now, reopenings, political rallies, summer parties.
You know, on May 29th, we saw that Arizona was having higher than expected levels of transmission. So, you know, taking a step back for just a moment, our data is not just providing information about fever levels across the country. There's other components of that data. We've unpacked the data and looked at transmission rates. How fast is an illness spreading in a local area? And similar to what you see on Health Weather, where we look at fever levels and subtract out what you'd normally expect from cold and flu, we're doing the same with transmission levels. We're seeing transmission levels and we're subtracting out what you'd normally expect for cold and flu. And that is often indicative of COVID-19. So we now have two different but related measures to identify outbreaks early. And that transmission data may very well be an even stronger signal and an even earlier signal. And we're publishing some of this information with academic partners. But that helped us to identify on May 29th early signs that we were seeing infection spread in Arizona. We also saw and announced on June 9th Florida and Texas. We're seeing higher than expected levels of transmission indicative of an outbreak. And last week, we saw the same with Oklahoma and Missouri.
Well, and just to be clear, these bumps that you were seeing were more than 9 days before the COVID case spikes in those states. You're seeing the temperatures go up before people, you know, are getting tested, before the testing's catching up with that.
Yeah, that's right. We're seeing the temperatures go up. We're seeing the transmission rates go up. And the reason for that is we get the people in their home from their first sign or symptom of an illness. One thing that is a challenge in this environment is, you know, the healthcare system doesn't see mildly symptomatic spread. We do. We get to see when someone gets sick, but perhaps never enters the healthcare system because they don't get sick enough. And they may pass that to a family member, someone they're in close proximity to, who might have no symptoms at all, but is still a carrier. And then a third person gets sick and finally gets sick enough to enter the healthcare system. The healthcare system is delayed in terms of its ability to pick up cases because of those delays. The healthcare system sees someone on average 5 to 8 days after they get symptoms. But remember, that's when they get severely sick enough to go into the healthcare system. They may have had a family member that gave it to them even days earlier than that and never got sick enough to enter the healthcare system. So it's all these delays that compound, which is why the outbreak is going from a flame to an inferno before the healthcare system can detect it. And we get to detect it when it's still a flame. And the whole idea here is if you can contain an outbreak early, you have a chance at stopping it and you isolate it. When you see an outbreak in a particular location in a state, well, that's indicative of like, well, I need to start deploying my PPE, send the test kits in, send the PPE in, send the virologists in, possibly implement social distancing areas, but in a more isolated, geographically pinpointed way than a broad way, right? And those are the kinds of steps that we can take as a system. And frankly, we should be alerting people in those local areas about spread, right? Knowledge is power. In our experience, we've been doing this for a very long time with flu, for the past 7 years with flu. When you alert people that there's a spike in flu, they take action. They stay indoors. They use disinfectants more. So there's multiple levels of actions that can be taken when you can detect it that early.
So, yeah, I mean, it could be as simple as people, you know, public health officials saying, hey, we've got an outbreak here. We can see it because of these fevers that are being tracked. So everybody be aware. I mean, it can be that simple. Last week, your data was showing rises in Louisiana, Missouri, Maine, Oklahoma. Maine since then has reimposed some restrictions. Oklahoma, as you forecasted, has become one of the country's hotspots. So look ahead. You know, what are you seeing right now that we might hear about in 2 weeks?
The places that we're most concerned about right now that where we're going to, it's Oklahoma and Missouri. Those are the places we're most concerned about right at this moment in terms of new outbreaks developing. We remain concerned about Texas because we're seeing increasing transmission levels there. We're not seeing those level off. So those are three of the places where, you know, I'm watching and I'm concerned.
Can you see, for instance, the effect of a president's rally?
We don't have the ability to attribute why the spread is occurring. And, you know, in Oklahoma itself, we certainly are able to see state-level illness. We don't have enough sensors in that particular state to really start isolating it down to very specific geographies. We need more. We need more sensors in the state to be able to do pinpointed, geographically precise outbreak detection.
That reminds me, you've given away a ton of these thermometers. They are for sale also at the website. We'll link people up at herenow.org. You know, what you're saying is you need as many people as possible to participate.
That's exactly right. The more people that participate, the more pinpointed we can get with the outbreak detection. I'm thrilled that we're partnering with a number of states, Connecticut, Oregon, Idaho, and other cities as well. Philadelphia announced us as part of the reopening plan. Colorado is doing a demonstration project as well. And we're partnering with those states to get more thermometers out to people, including underserved communities and especially underserved communities who might seek care and treatment later. But that's right. Mm-hmm. The more thermometers out there, the better the hotspotting abilities. And just to put a fine point on it, this is not just a benefit for the communities, for the health system and for the government. This is a benefit to the individuals, right? You get to see, you get the data, you get to see whether there's illness going around your local community. You get tools to help you understand how to respond to your illness, right? The thermometer connects into a medical guidance system and provides you with age-based medical guidance. And again, you get to see the data. If you participate, you see it.
That's Inder Singh of Kinza Thermometers. We'll link you up to lots of information at hereandnow.org. Inder, you've been doing this work for years, and now scientists, researchers, policymakers are scrambling to get their hands on it. I'm just betting that's a good feeling in the middle of a pandemic.
You know, I'm sad that it took a pandemic to bring to light how important this work on early warning is. I'm thrilled that we survived as an organization to get here. I mean, it's been 8 years. We've been working on this day and night for flu and proving the concept. So I'm thrilled that it's working. But let me be clear. People need to use the data. This can't be just research projects. This can't be projects that are in hindsight. We have a ton. We have more than 150 scientists and public health officials that are looking at the data. But what's unclear is who's using them, which decision makers are actually using the data to implement policies. This is not a big leap of faith. This is not, if you see fever levels rise in a particular area, you know it's an outbreak. And if it's above and beyond what you'd expect for cold and flu season, you know it's an unusual outbreak. Today, that's COVID-19. And I want to make sure that politicians, governors, mayors, you know, policymakers are using the data. I can't imagine how hard it is for a governor, for a mayor to make decisions that essentially pits livelihoods versus lives. And I can't imagine how hard that decision has been made. And they're doing it on the basis of expert advice, but they're doing it without real-time data to know whether their actions are actually having an impact. And I want to be clear, they have data. It's available. It's at healthweather.us. Call us. We will provide whatever data cuts we can. Use it. It needs to be used in this current crisis. Mm-hmm. This is the whole reason we started the company, is to detect, predict, and help respond to outbreaks. And this is an opportunity for us to use the data to have a really massive public health impact. And so, you know, we're exhausted, but we're thrilled that we can help. But again, the data needs to be used. It cannot just be a research project. People need to be using the data.
Don't make the Kinza thermometer the new politicized health weapon, as was done with the mask. Inder Singh, thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Actress Tracy Ellis Ross is used to people talking about her age a lot. And she's okay with whatever people say.
I'm 47 years old, and I'm the most comfortable in my skin I've ever been. What, when we go back to being 22? No, thank you.
The Blackish star on Confronting an Ageist World. Listen and subscribe to It's Been a Minute from NPR.
The call for changing the names of 10 southern military bases is gaining momentum in Washington. But then the question is, what names might replace those of the Confederate generals they now bear? Jay Price from member station WUNC reports.
When Larry Wright was stationed at Fort Bragg, North Carolina in the 1970s, 80s, and 90s, the name of the base wasn't a big topic, even among black soldiers like him.
We didn't talk about it a lot, but we heard here and there that it was a Confederate general, and it was a confusion because we said, well, how did they get the name bases after generals that did not win the war?
Generals who were fighting for slavery and a war against the U.S. Army. But times have changed, and Wright, now a minister and Fayetteville, North Carolina city council member, says Bragg and the other bases across the South need to reflect that. They don't all need to be renamed for black military heroes or prominent black leaders, but some should if they're going to bear the names of Americans.
There needs to be a diversity of names that is chosen that reflect the country, reflect our communities in which we live, probably one of the most diverse countries in the world, and that would do us proud.
Joseph Gladhar, who teaches military history at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, says Braxton Bragg was a poor namesake even beyond the central issue that he defended slavery. A slave owner in civilian life, he was tactically competent but a terrible leader, cantankerous and widely hated by the men who served with him.
I wouldn't rank him. He wouldn't make a list unless you had to include, say, 500 or 300 or something. But if you asked me to give you the 10 best officers in the Confederate Army, he wouldn't be in there, or 20.
Picking new names for old bases won't be simple. Anthony Shore founded Operative Words, an agency that helps develop names for companies and products. He says professional name developers have to accept that people have subjective and sometimes idiosyncratic reactions to names.
So it may be that not every name could please every person. That is a possibility. But we certainly know that some paths are more likely to lead to a broader acceptance, and other paths are likely to diminish that broad acceptance.
Shore said the nation is in the middle of a sea change in which tolerance for racially insensitive names appears to be ending. He cited Quaker Oats' decision to change its Aunt Jemima brand, for example. As for the bases, Shore said good options could include people who never served in the military but whose lives embodied shared American values. Or it may be more productive to move away from people's names entirely and think about ideals or attributes.
You know, we have the USS Constitution, for example. Could something like that also be applied to a military base? And then, of course, we have geography. Our country is home to countless places of inspiring and majestic natural beauty. And surely that could be a productive resource for names that every American could be proud of.
He said a good practice in naming things is to listen to all the key stakeholders and walk them through the implications of potential names.
Because when you're presenting names, what you're really doing is you're presenting potential futures. And so my job when I present names is to help everyone in the room see what that future might be if they go with any one of those names.
And for Southern military bases, the nation may be about to move into a new future. For Here and Now, I'm Jay Price.
There are just over 4 months until Election Day, and polls are pointing to the possibility that Democrats will retake control of the Senate, which might include flipping the state of Iowa, where Republican Senator Joni Ernst will face Democrat Teresa Greenfield in November. For this week's Senate Tracker, let's bring in Radio Iowa News Director O.K. Henderson. Hi, Kay.
Hi.
And let's talk about the candidates. Joni Ernst, Senator Joni Ernst, elected to her seat in 2014. She is a combat veteran, and she did an interview with Fox News this week and was asked about protesters' efforts to tear down statues, including one of Andrew Jackson, who owned slaves. Let's listen.
We need to restore law and order here in the United States. And of course, we support protests. And there are still some folks that are out there protesting police brutality, racial injustice. But peaceful protests is what we are looking for, dialogue. And what we are seeing is just plain old vandalism.
Okay, interesting to hear that on the protests. How is Ernst positioning herself in this race right now?
Well, interestingly, you mentioned she's a combat veteran. She's also expressed support for the idea of renaming some of the bases around the country that are currently named for Confederate officers. And she has positioned herself firmly in the Trump camp. She's part of GOP leadership in the Senate. She has been pushing the Trump agenda, and she is hoping that, you know, maybe this is a base election and it's not about turning out independents and convincing independents that they need to vote for you.
And what about the Democrat, Teresa Greenfield? She's a businesswoman who's been talking a lot about how she grew up on an Iowa farm and also a big loss when she was in her 20s. Her first husband died. Here's a recent ad.
I was 24 and pregnant at home with a 13-month-old when I got a knock at the door. It was the priest. My husband, Rod, a union electrician, had been killed on the job. I'm Teresa Greenfield, and Social Security survivor benefits help save our family. So when I see Washington politicians take millions from Wall Street and then threaten to privatize and cut Social Security, I say no way.
What more can you tell us about Teresa Greenfield?
Well, interestingly, in the early phase of this race, she's been attempting to talk a lot about the Affordable Care Act, and you just heard her mention Social Security, two things that she is promising if elected to preserve. The other thing about this is that the Ernst campaign is trying to really highlight Teresa Greenfield's past business record in the real estate industry. They've been referring to her as Chuck Schumer's handpicked candidate. Meanwhile, the Greenfield campaign is attempting to tie Ernst with Trump. So this in many ways could be, as some of these Senate races are turning out to be around the country, a referendum on Trump.
Now, he won the state of Iowa by 9 points in 2016 after President Obama won it twice before that. If this is a referendum on Trump, how is the president doing there in Iowa right now?
Well, an Iowa poll that came out earlier this month showed the race with Biden tight. Iowa could again be a swing state. And we have some polling statewide by the Des Moines Register Iowa poll that was released on June 13th. On this particular race, it showed Greenfield ahead of Ernst, 46-43. It found that for the first time, Ernst's job approval rating was, you know, what we say below the watermark. It was 49%. It also found that about 39% of those surveyed didn't know a lot about Greenfield and they hadn't yet formed an opinion about her. Interestingly, it showed that Greenfield had a huge advantage among female voters. She had a 20-point lead among female voters in that survey.
Hmm. Is there a lot of outside money coming into this race?
Well, let's look back to 2014. There was $85 million spent on the race that Joni Ernst won that year, and her opponent was sitting Congressman Bruce Braley. Only 20% of that $85 million was spent by the two candidates, and you can be assured that since this is one of the targeted races by Democrats, that there's going to be tons of outside money coming in. And so I wouldn't be surprised if it far eclipses that $85 million figure from 2014.
You know, Kate, just thinking about Iowa, you're making me very nostalgic because the Iowa caucuses were one of the last trips that I took before all the shutdowns. And I just remember crisscrossing that state and then getting on a plane through Chicago back home and seeing, I think, one person with a mask because this was in February, just at the beginning of COVID-19 in the United States. But anyway, we will, I'm sure, be watching Iowa for the next many months and leading up to this race and Election Day. Kay Henderson, Radio Iowa News Director, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, a brutal murder in Guatemala this month has put the spotlight on tensions between evangelical Christians and those who practice traditional Maya religion. The victim was a famous Maya healer and expert in plant medicines. Reporter Maria Martin has our story and a warning. You're about to hear disturbing audio of the murder.
This YouTube video shows indigenous healer Domingo Chokche surrounded by fellow Maya villagers in Guatemala's northern rainforest. The 56-year-old Chok appears weak as a white-shirted man grabs him and douses him with gasoline from a plastic jug. Suddenly, the man known respectfully by many as Tata or Grandfather Domingo is transformed into a smoking ball of fire. People stand around watching. Some hold up cell phones, filming the moment. No one comes to his aid. A few days later, Chok supporters gathered in the Plaza de la Constitución in the heart of Guatemala City. They burned incense and lit a sacred fire on an altar of flowers.
El Tata Domingo Chok era un guía espiritual, un profesional, un investigador.
Tata Domingo Chok was a spiritual guide, a professional, a researcher, says mourner Amelia Tunco. At the time of his death, Chok was collaborating on a study of healing plants with Dr. Michael Heinrich of University College London. He says Chok's death brings to mind a saying in Spanish.
Every elder who dies is like a library that burns down. So what you see here is a loss of this wisdom, of this ability to engage with the community in terms of healthcare.
Days after the killing, Guatemalan police arrested four evangelical Christians, members of one family, and charged them with murder. Authorities say the suspects believed Chok had been practicing witchcraft. Indigenous rights activist Rosalina Tuyuk traces the roots of the killing back to Guatemala's civil war in the 1980s.
No hemos superado todas las secuencias que dejó el conflicto armado.
That was a time, Tuyuk says, when Protestantism and especially evangelicalism began to play a big role in Guatemala, when those who practice Maya traditional spirituality and Catholics were often accused of being communists or witches and persecuted. Virginia Garrard at the University of Texas Austin says even now, a quarter of a century after the war ended, some Pentecostal cults have a militaristic bent. There is, she says,
a specific variety of Pentecostals that practice this thing called spiritual warfare, which is casting out demons, which they take to be minions of Satan or Satan himself.
Garrard suspects this was the motive for Chuck's murder.
I assume that he and his practices were the embodiment that they despised.
Evangelical leaders did not respond to NPR's request for comments. The local Catholic bishop says it was personal and not religious differences that led to Chuck's murder. But human rights groups report that in recent years, nearly 20 indigenous healers have been attacked or killed. And although the accused in Chuck's murder are themselves Kekchi Maya, Maya scholar Maria Aguilar believes racism was a factor.
We have to think about the colonial legacy that has permeated indigenous communities and certain sectors into making them believe that our spiritual practices can be seen as witchcraft.
Since the murder, another healer involved in the research with Chuck and the London professor Michael Heinrich has gone into hiding.
So the current generation of healers already is in a very difficult situation in terms of a very fragile social structure. Call it racism or not, but there is an element in it of denigrating a person's right to see the world in a certain way.
And that includes, says Heinrich, his right to practice his religion and his kind of medicine. For NPR News, I'm Maria Martin.
The baseball season is usually a 162-game marathon. This year it might be a 60-game sprint played in empty ballparks. And what was Djokovic thinking? Let's check in on this weird year in sports with Mike Pesca here now, sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Mike, I can't believe how much we find to talk about every week.
Yeah, weird year in sports, weird year in year.
Yeah, that's right. Overall. Well, baseball took a lot of negotiation to get to this week's deal between Major League Baseball and players. Coronavirus is not going away. If anything, it's surging. So what's the plan?
Well, it is a detailed plan. It is a very well thought out plan. There, you could perhaps nitpick some aspects of it, but here is the problem with the plan. And it's not that it's the plan, it's that the plan will be implemented in the United States. So we've seen the Bundesliga in Germany operate successfully, and we see the Korean Baseball League. And if this plan were implemented in a country like Germany or Denmark or Korea, where coronavirus was low, I think we should be very optimistic. But the problem with the Florida Marlins playing the Arizona Diamondbacks is that it's Florida and Arizona, and not just those two states, but we don't know where the pandemic is going to crest, where it is going to go from here. Remember, in the beginning, there were these bubbles that were supposed to be in Florida and Arizona, the safe states. Now they are some of the worst states. So I do think, I am not damning this plan, but I do think, and I wonder if there is the proper acknowledgement that this virus could have a plan of its own. And I wonder how Major League Baseball is prepared to react to that.
Yeah. Well, meanwhile, as that unfolds, there are a lot of people who want to seize this moment to make some changes in baseball. You know, the games go on too long. Is there a sense that this might be an opportunity to experiment?
Oh, yeah, more than a sense. And that's part of the plan. They're putting in a number of rules changes. Some of them don't go exactly at the length of the game. For instance, designated hitters will be used in the National League. And that's probably something that was a long time coming, the National League being the only league really in the world that allows pitchers to hit. But here's a big change. In extra innings, a player will start at second base. So this will definitely decrease the length of games. This has been tried in the minor leagues. There is a score in the first inning, something over 70% of the time when a player starts at second base. Without that, it's less than half the time. It absolutely will decrease the length of games. However, this isn't a tweak. This isn't a change. This is a massive overhaul. And I know baseball purists can be cranky, and there are certainly a number of people who don't want to change anything. But I think this change is just so abrupt, it's been met with near universal condemnation. Maybe there are other things to do to shorten the length of games. We'll see how it goes. It's a little laboratory for experimentation this 60-game season.
You know, it's just so funny when you say that, because it sounds like, you know, when I was in grade school with kickball, okay, you can start on third base. You know, anybody winks, you know, anybody else. Okay,
right.
To Novak Djokovic, he and his wife tested positive for COVID-19 after taking part in that tennis exhibition that he organized in Serbia and Croatia. No social distancing precautions, lots of partying. Before he was diagnosed, top players got sick, and he said of them, hey, I can't tell people what to do. Now he's positive. Those players going back to home countries. What do you think this means for these big tennis events, the French Open, the U.S. Open?
Well, Djokovic he's an anti-vaxxer, and he just doesn't understand or acknowledge science. And that might actually cut two ways, in that perhaps the tennis community will say, oh, we're the careful ones. We wouldn't take the risks that Djokovic did. And I look at the plans for, say, the U.S. Open, and play will start in Australia. And I don't think they're being incautious. But to go, for instance, the U.S. Open plan, they're going to combine that with the tournament that occurs beforehand, the Western and Southern tournament that usually occurs in Cincinnati. There will be a 24-game bubble. New York right now seems to be the virus seems to be on the decline. But I would hope they wouldn't look at Djokovic and say, oh, we're not going to be as foolish as that, therefore we'll be safe. You could do everything right and be very smart and still not be safe. However, Djokovic did not do almost anything right or smart.
Well, but as you said, you know, when you think you have a bubble, you don't. Golf is back, no fans, but some caddies for some top players have tested positive. Some baseball, basketball, football, hockey players have tested positive. You know, even though people think they have these bubbles, they don't.
Yeah, and that could be the wake-up call. So a bunch of Philadelphia Phillies went out for maybe a night on the town, and then there was rampant spread among them. We've just heard that some members of the Colorado Rockies, we don't know how they got it, but this is happening to them. The Orlando Pride, the soccer team. I think what it may be, maybe these early warnings will be wake-up calls, and maybe this will show that there is no acceptable amount of going out and telling yourself to take it casually. That said, what happens when there is a big spread among a team and 5 or 10 players go down, to take it back to baseball? Baseball has these rules where they're going to have taxi squads and available 60 players. But I kind of get the sense that their plan is a little like the Union plan during the Civil War. They're just going to play it like a war of attrition. Yet I don't know that that could practically work. If you lose so many players, how do you still have a season, still have the team, not endanger others? So many questions.
Mike Pesca, driving everyone to the history books. Mike Pesca here now, sports analyst. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Where else do you get an analogy to the Civil War? Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now.